We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NapaClub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And our speaker tonight is a member of Bridge Builders, and I've seen her and heard her share a lot, and I always like what she has to say. And with that, I'll give you Pat.
I'm Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. I've never spoken in front of a mic before, so I looked at that and I just got nervous. My sobriety date is, my sobriety date is 1980, May 22nd or May 23rd. I never thought to write it down at the time, and now I'm too old to remember. Approximately that. I came in here when I was 52 years old. Whirr, I can hear it, the adding. 83. And I'm very, very grateful to be 83 years old because I was headed straight for death. I mean, I just was drinking myself to death. And I was wishing myself to death. I would go to bed at night and say, oh, please, let me die now. But I'm getting, that's the middle of my story. The first of my story is I was born into a very alcoholic family. My father was alcoholic. Oh, I see another friend came in, and I thank my friends, all the readers are dear friends, and so nice of them to come tonight. My father was an alcoholic. He came from a family of alcoholics. He had four brothers and sisters, and only one of them was not an alcoholic. They all died of their alcoholism. My dad died young of his alcoholism. Now, I love my dad. I just absolutely adored him. He was the kind of alcoholic who just was lots and lots of fun. And I never saw him raise his hand to anybody. He didn't holler. My mother was the hollerer. And I can't say as I really blame her. But she took it out on all of us. All of us got it because of my father. But he died a very sad death, and I didn't understand when he got to the end of his life. My mother had to go back to work. All the insurance was used up so that after he died, she had to work. And I was not angry with him. I was very disappointed. And it took me to be an alcoholic to understand what he went through. He just became nothing. He just became so he shuffled. It was very sad to me. Then my poor mom, she got three alcoholics, both of my brothers and myself. And for me, it was, you know, I was very shy when I was young. I was chubby. My brothers used to call me Fatty Patty. I didn't think it was very nice of, in retrospect, it wasn't very nice of my mother to let them do that, but that's what happened. I love my brothers too. They have both since died of this disease. One was 52 years old. I had only been sober 2 years when he died. And the other was just short of his 60th birthday. And I had been in the program 7 years when he died. And I miss them, you know. I miss them. They could be with me still. As I started to say, I was very shy. And like so many people say, the first drink, I felt like I could be the same as everybody else. I could dance at a party. I could smile at a boy. And other than that, I was just really, really. I used to think that when I was a little girl, I used to think that people were watching me out of the window walking down the sidewalks. You know, I know that's ridiculous now, but when I was little, I thought they were looking at me and not approving. And so beer eased things for me. When I was old enough, I think my first drink was maybe 15, 16, but it wasn't a steady thing then. It was when I could get to a party where they had beer. And my older brother was very attractive to the girls, so I was invited into a sorority when I was much too young, just simply because they wanted me in the sorority so they could get to my brother. I mean, it's just, you know. So if I go to their parties, I would have a beer or two beers. I can remember one time my brother said to me, he was to see that I got home okay, and he said, "It's time to go." And I said, "No, I don't want to go yet. I'm just having fun. I'm not ready to go." And he finally left without me, and he got home, and my mother said, "Where's your sister?" And he said, "She's still at the party." And he had to come all the way back and get me. And it was a long time before he wanted to be my chaperone again. We moved around a great deal, and that didn't help any of my shyness at all, partially due to my father's alcoholism and partially to the depression, the Great Depression. We moved from one city to another, and I would just barely get to one city and we'd be on our way to another, and I never felt like I made friends, you know. I did meet a man in high school my senior year, and he had another girlfriend, but I eventually married him. We were 22 when we were married, and you know, we would drink beer going out. Well, he couldn't afford anything but beer, so I drank beer, which I never really liked, but I always drank whatever was available. You know, if it was there, I didn't like scotch, but if that was all there was, I would drink scotch. So all there was when we were dating and when we were first married was beer. We were so poor when we were first married. You know, we ate hamburger and hot dogs. He was still in school. But all the while, when we were first married, he was still in school, and we became the official chaperones at the fraternity parties and so forth. And what was really good about that was they gave you a bottle, you know. And so we had a bottle, which we never had otherwise. And then when we had our first child while he was still in school, and his senior year, and we would put Janet upstairs in the attic, and a freshman would sit at the bottom of the stairs and listen for the baby, so we could just party. And I just thought I was so wonderful because I outdrank everybody. You know, they'd be passed out in the halls, and I'd be stepping over them looking for the next party, and it was fun in those years. You know, it was fun. My alcoholism just proceeded to the depth of perhaps the depth of our pockets, you know. I had a neighbor who I was very close with and remained close for many, many years. And I had shared with her that I was an alcoholic and that I was in AA. And she said, "You know," she said, "I remember," and this I didn't remember, she said, "I remember you're wanting me to drink a beer with you at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And she said, I would come over, but I didn't really want a beer at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I was, you know, I was getting there and showing the signs a lot before I had any idea of it. And quite often, if we would go out in later years, or even early years, I couldn't stomach the booze, the first one or two. I would get very flushed. I eventually solved that by drinking before we went out, so the flushes would be gone. I would very often, I loved martinis because they got you there pretty well, pretty fast. I quite often would have maybe one or two and have to go into the ladies' room and throw it up. But I would come right back out and have more. I mean, it didn't seem to, you know, if you were allergic to strawberries and you got the hives or threw up, you wouldn't have them anymore, would you? Too bad booze doesn't work that way. Anyway, we moved around a lot again when I was married because my husband was in a kind of business where you move. Each step, when we lived in North Carolina, the liquor store was really a long ways away. I think it was something like 20 miles to just go get liquor. And if we had company, that was when we had some liquor in the cabinet. Actually, we had quite a bit of company because it was, Ben would come down in business and my husband would call and say, could you put another cup of water in the soup? I'm bringing someone home for dinner. So somebody brought us one time some White Lightning or whatever you want to call it. I don't, that's the only name I can think of, but you know what I mean. Home booze, and boy, it was murder. But quite often there wouldn't be anything, so that's what I would drink before he got home or when he was away. And the lady who, the help, got blamed for it when he saw how far it had gone down. I don't know, maybe Mary likes it, you know. So I was beginning my sneaky ways. I wasn't going to the liquor store by myself yet. But I was, you know, that was yet to come. We moved from North Carolina up to Connecticut, and I was able to go to the liquor store whenever I wanted, you know. I just found many of them because I didn't want anybody in the liquor store to think that I had a problem. By this time, I was definitely drinking by 4 o'clock by myself before my husband got home, which was a real no-no, but I needed to, and I especially needed to. I didn't understand this when I would go out to lunch with the girls. You know, we would always have a cocktail. Okay, I could stay to one. One time I had two, and everybody looked at me so strange that I didn't do that again. When I would have one at lunch, then I couldn't wait until my usual 4 o'clock, and I would have to start drinking when I got home from lunch. And I didn't understand a compulsion. And So the thing is, I'm drinking more and more and more, and I'm hiding more and more and more, and I'm lying more and more and more. And I had, after I got sober, I would have drunk dreams once in a while, that they would always be, well, especially when I had a little more time under my belt, like say 20, 25 years, I would occasionally have a dream that I was drunk, and I didn't know how I got that way, and I would have a glass in my hand, and I would think, but I can't be drunk. I'm in AA. And then in the dream, I would say, oh, well, I just won't tell them. You know, I'll go back, I just won't tell them. Which was, when I'd wake up, I'd think, that's exactly what you were like when you were drinking. Ooh, excuse me. Hey, really make a point with that, couldn't you? Slam on the table. I was just becoming dishonest. I don't like what I was. I don't like what I was at all. I finally got, my husband traveled a lot, he always did, and he was traveling more and more and going to stranger and stranger places, and I was drinking more and more. But you know, I always waited until 4 o'clock, because I guess I thought that was proper. I don't know what it was. At 4 o'clock, it was like the compulsion was get to that liquor thing, you know, liquor cabinet, and we had everything, because we didn't want somebody to come to our house and want cream de menthe and not have cream de menthe, you know. And so I would whirl this little thing around, this Lazy Susan around, and decide what I was going to have to drink that night. Now, I got so I wouldn't drink martinis because they got me too drunk. I'd think, well, I'll wait till Friday night for that. Well, you know, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? So I would go to bed. I would lots of times sort of have to crawl up the stairs. I would go to bed asking my higher power, who I didn't even believe in at the time, to let me die. My thought was, nobody cares. My two children were grown up and out of the house by then. My son was doing his own thing with alcohol, which I didn't even suspect. Alcohol and pot, and I didn't know, had no idea. My husband lost his job, which was very good when he'd been with that company for 25 years. And he almost immediately got a job down in North Carolina. So he packed up all of his things. And when he left, it looked like he intended to move out, you know. But he was talking about my getting the house ready to sell. And he came back, you know, on weekends. And in January, he told me he wanted a divorce. And I asked him if it was the booze, and he said no. And I said, is there another woman? No. Well, he had his hobby, and I had my hobby. Somebody was waiting in the wings. And I found out later, you know, people love to come and tell you things that they wouldn't tell you. And I guess it hadn't been the only time. So I'm drinking and he's partying otherwise. However, I was absolutely crushed. I mean, this was not, we'd been married 30 years. And the day he left, I just started drinking in the middle of the day, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And I knew, you know, I'd look in the mirror and say, you're a drunk, and you're going to die in the bottom of the bottle, because I didn't know I didn't know any way out. I thought, you know, I know you won't be offended. I thought AA was a bunch of bums. It wasn't for a lady like me, you know. So this went on into May. Now, my daughter in D.C. had been extremely, extremely kind to me about the divorce. I mean, she came up and helped me in so many ways. And she called me on the phone, I think it was maybe in March, and she said, "Mom," she said, "you know, I just can't come up and see you anymore when you're drinking." Well, this couldn't happen. You know, I could not lose this child. I just couldn't lose this child. And I told my doctor, and he said, I don't think you're an alcoholic. He said, "But I'd like you to see a psychiatrist." So I went to see the psychiatrist, and I told him a little bit about my drinking. Not a lot, a little bit. And what he would say to me at the end of each meeting was, "You know, we really can't do anything until you address your drinking. There's a nice women's meeting over at Meridian Center." Well, I didn't want to do that. But here, maybe I was going to lose my daughter, and maybe I was going to lose my psychiatrist, who I wanted to tell him about all the horrible, horrible things that had happened to me in my life, and him to tell me, "Well, that's why you're this way." So, but he didn't do that. Come to find out later that he was the psychiatrist for the Meridian Center, which was the sobriety center in Stamford, Connecticut, where I was living. So I decided I'd try it one day. Now, this is April. It was raining. I had a raincoat on. I had a hat pulled down over my face. My biggest fear was somebody would see me, you know, and know that I was going into an AA meeting. And that remained a fear for quite a while. And I was also afraid I'd see somebody I know, you know. And it turned out I did see somebody I know two or three times. But anyway, I went to this meeting. I couldn't understand why everybody was being so nice to me. I was very, very fortunate because a woman who was younger than I was, but who she told my story, you know. It just resonated with me because I thought, "Oh my gosh, she feels the way I do." And I was kind of horrified because one said, "Oh, I'll take you to a Sunday meeting," and I thought, "Well, I've just been to a meeting." And then another one came and said she'd take me up to Real on Monday, and I thought, "Sunday, Monday, this is Friday, you know." And but I did it, you know. I went, and I liked all of you. I liked AA people. They were understandably kind and nice to me, and I liked it. So I did keep coming, but I didn't quit drinking for, I think it was maybe 6 weeks, because I came and I entered in April. Now, I didn't tell anybody I was drinking, and I was still, it was still 4 o'clock was the witching hour when I go in and start drinking. I presume they knew. You know, but they were still nice. They were still trying to give me their telephone numbers and, you know, all that wonderful things that happened in here. And there was one man who greeted me at the door every single day. He was a character, big cowboy hat and boots, but I came to love him. I mean, you know, because he was such a dear, kind man to everybody. One day, I just decided, okay, this is the day. And I called, I had a bottle of wine. And I didn't really drink much wine because wine didn't get you any place. I mean, it just wasn't quick enough, you know. I tried it, but then I had to hide a juice glass of booze behind the toaster, you know, and I'd drink the wine out where my husband was, and I'd go back in the kitchen and have a slug of the real stuff. So I called my neighbors and I said, would you bring cardboard cartons and come and get the liquor out of my house? Good friends, they were dear friends. And they said, oh, we can carry it without cardboard cartons. Well, I want to tell you, they had to go back and get the cardboard cartons because we had a supply. But, you know, I'm afraid to hit this table. The thing is, the day I said I was going to quit, I had a gift from my higher power. And that gift was I never had the compulsion again. I don't mean I never thought of a drink again, but I didn't have this terrible, terrible pull to a drink. And I truly believe that was a gift. I don't know where I was. A gift. Beginning of sobriety. I came to meeting every day. I don't remember hearing 90 meetings in 90 days. If they said it, I didn't hear it, but I came every day because I was so lonesome. I would go into my house and close the garage door and I would just sink in my heart and in my mind. So if I came to lunch, they served lunch every day, ham and Swiss cheese and turkey, and after the first year, I swore I would never eat a ham or a Swiss cheese sandwich again. But I do, occasionally. But I came because I was so lonesome that I just, it gave me that something. And if that's the only reason you come, good, you know, because I didn't understand anything. I didn't understand the steps. I wasn't crazy. These things did not apply to me. Never mind that I was getting a divorce and, I know now that they apply to me and I try to live by the steps. But it took me a long time. You know, every once in a while somebody would say something and it was like a little light bulb would go off. And I'd think, oh, yeah, maybe that's what they mean. Maybe that's what they're trying to tell me. It took me a long time. I when I was a little girl, I went to church and I believed in God. But I lost that while I was drinking. And I lost it. I got to the point where I like to say my higher power, because when I was afraid, when I first came in, when we all stood around and said the Lord's Prayer, I thought, oh boy, maybe this is a cult, you know. It frightened me, and don't be frightened, because it took my son has been in 20 years, God's blessing to me. And it took him a long time to get. It took me a long time, but it took him longer. But finally, one day, he said to me, Mom, I do believe in God. And I said, well, that's wonderful, David. And he looked at me and he said, I know I didn't do this by myself, you know. And that's how I feel. I know I couldn't do this by myself. But in order to get in touch with a higher power, this was not conscious, but what I quite often found myself doing was going and sitting in a church. Any church, I'd go by it, you know, at a fair, it was on church grounds or something like that, and I'd just go and sit, you know, and Another thing that made me want it very much was AA, you people, because I could see, or felt I could, for me, I felt I could see it in other people, and I wanted what they had, you know. So I don't know how. I was going to say something that isn't right. I was going to say I don't know how strong my faith is. My faith is very strong. My faith is very strong. I'm not certain what it is, except to me it's a God who's taking care of me, and I ask Him at night to show me the way, and I ask Him in the morning to show me what to do and tell me how to do it, or vice versa. So, you know. If you're afraid of that, don't leave because of that, because it might creep up on you, you know. When I was in this program for 7 years, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. It's even hard to say. I told my friends at AA that that's what I had, and they would have to help me get through it. The way I decided the best way for me and is that I use, it's the same as AA, it's a day at a time. You know, today I'm okay. Maybe next week I'll have to stay home for a couple of days, you know. But it's like AA, a day at a time is, you know, how I handle it. I've had heartbreaks in AA, losing my brothers and other members of my family. I've had great joy. Because of AA, I got the courage to drive west by myself, and I liked it so much I did it 5 times. I just took most of the month of April, because I don't have responsibilities at home, and just drove out there and just saw everything, and it was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I have a wonderful family. My children are all very good to me. I have a grandson and a granddaughter, and I have a great grandmother. I have a little Ella, who is 9 months, and wow, she's sure cute. Got pictures if you want it. I'm very, very grateful for everything I have. Very grateful. It's not just the things that you can have in your hand. It's the things that you can have in your heart, like my little baby. I like to read, and I like to stitch, and I'm so grateful that I have things that I can do for myself that make me happy and take away the loneliness, you know. I heard a woman say at a meeting one day, she became a very, very dear friend, and all the women were sitting around grousing about having to fix dinner, and their husbands did this and the husbands did that. And Annie said, "Well, I'd like to share." She said, "You know," she said, "I don't have anybody sitting on the couch waiting, asking me what's for dinner." And I thought, that's, you know, that's the way to look at it. That, I mean, I try to be cheerful, you know. Why not? It feels much better than being miserable and complaining. I'm trying to make myself a saint here. I'm very sorry. I'm not. I'm far from it. And when I came down here to Napa, when I moved down here, period, I just went into a total funk. I was just... there was too much for me to have to cope with all at once. You know, it was just, you know, changing driver's license. There were things I forgot to do, like cancel my driver's license up north, and they were after me for almost 2 years with tax bills or something, for not being there. All these, I lost my credit card. No, I didn't lose my credit card. Somebody used it. I don't know how they used it. I mean, it was compromised. Everything happened. And I didn't cope with it very well. And I found myself not even saying my prayers. I lost it, you know. So I didn't become a saint, and I don't have any chance. I heard a newcomer share one night that he was afraid he'd become perfect and he wouldn't like that. And I just wanted to laugh because I don't think any of us will ever become perfect, no matter how long we're in here. I speak for myself. I will not become perfect. I know that. I guess I've got a little more time, and I feel like I'm just rambling or rolling. What do I do now, Tim? Okay.
Thank you, Pat. Richard will be handing out the chips.
Hi, everybody. My name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic
addict.
At the Monday night group chip meeting, we have a chip system to mark our way of sobriety. Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Tim. We have a white chip for 24 hours. Anybody like to pick up a white chip? Silver chip for 30 days. Yellow chip for 90 days? No. Red chip for 90 days. Anybody got 90 days? 6 months of yellow chip. 9 months of green chip. Any years or months was there that we don't know about? Well, congratulations on the chip you have.
Okay, now we have just a brief moment for AA and NAVA Club announcements. Anybody would like to start? No announcements.
Hey,
okay.
Hi, it's Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Hey,
Tim.
And I have Tim will tell you a little about the affair we're having a week from Saturday. I have some tickets and Tim has I'm going to put a couple of baskets on the table for anyone that was late coming in. This group and that would really need support. And also, a couple of people can help us clean up at the end of the meeting. Take just a couple of minutes. A couple will help. It'll really help.
We appreciate the volunteers, for sure. September 10th, Saturday night, 9:30, we're going to set up for a beach party. And we're going to have Myrtle Beach music, all kinds of, basically sobriety theme. And then downstairs we're going to have an open mic coffee house and Tinsley Ellis, who's one of us from NAVA, and also happens to be one of the R&B guitar legends around. And he's going to play, and we're going to have some other guest musicians, and even have a comedian, I think, and DVDs and the serving food downstairs. So, mass tickets are $5. Yes?
I'd like to say something. I have a snowball business, and I talked to Frank about maybe coming next Saturday and doing snowballs. If any of y'all are interested, if you'd like to do that, I make all kind of flavors. I make hurricane, pina colada, strawberry, and they're doing really good, and they're cold. It's a real fluffy ice, and something I think you'd like.
Perfect for the beach party.
Thank you.
We definitely are looking forward to having you there.
Okay.
Okay, and then Nava Thursday Night Ministry is having a barbecue. And their advance tickets are $7. You know, they do this barbecue every year. It's world class. And it's the 7th annual 50th anniversary. That makes sense. I think we're 57 years old.
Okay. And then for Monday, September the 5th at 8, we've got speaker Tim B. of the Coming Group. And then on Monday, September 12th at 8, we have Paul H. And that's of Triangle's 9 a.m. Saturday men's group. Okay. See, in closing, I remind each of you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Child, picked up by